Shri Acharya, Asatara Siddhashri Srimad, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Jai.
ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai, Nam Acharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai,
Jai.
Prem Shikho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinashana Kunda Radha Kunda Givi Govardhan Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai, Mathura Dham Ki Jai, Navadvipa Mayapur Dham Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai, Ganga Nai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivase Sisanyavadi Paskachade Satarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagraja Tam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Sha Vanchakal Pajubis Chakri Pasindaviya Vachapati Tanam Pavanevio Vaishnaveva Namurama Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's October 13th, 2021 in Hawaii over the internet, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 28, Text 42. Pare Brahmani Chatmanam. Param Brahma Tatatmani. Vikshamano Vihakshe. Vikshamano Vihakshe Ksham. Asmat Uparaman Aha.
Asmat Uparaman.
Please chant. Hey. Transcendental.
Transcendental.
Ramani.
Ramani.
In the absolute.
In the absolute.
Cha.
Cha.
And.
And.
Atmanam.
Atmanam.
The self.
The self.
Param.
Param.
The supreme.
The supreme.
Brahma.
Brahma.
Absolute.
Absolute.
Tata.
Tata.
Also.
Also.
Atmani.
Atmani.
In himself.
In himself.
Vikshamana.
Vikshamana.
Thus observing.
Thus observing.
Vihaya.
Vihaya.
Giving up.
Giving up. Giving up.
Iksham.
Iksham.
Reservation.
Reservation.
Asmat.
Asmat.
From this process.
From this process.
From this process.
Upararama.
Upararama.
Retired. Ha. Certainly.
Certainly.
Muted. Unmuted.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. King Malayadraj could thus observe that the super soul was sitting by his side, and that he, as the individual soul, was sitting by the side of the super soul. Since both were together, there was no need for separate interests. Thus he ceased from such activities. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In the advanced stage of devotional service, the devotee does not see anything separate between his own interests and those of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Both interests become one, for the devotee does not act for a separate interest. Whatever he does in the interest of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. At that time, he sees everything in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in the Supreme Personality of Godhead in everything. Having attained this stage of understanding, he sees no distinction between the spiritual world. He sees no distinction between the spiritual and material worlds. In perfect vision, the material world becomes the spiritual world due to its being the external energy of the Supreme Lord. For the perfect devotee, the energy and the energetic are non-different. Thus, the so-called material world becomes spiritual, sarvam kalam idam brahma. Everything is intended for the service of the Supreme Lord, and the expert devotee can utilize any so-called material thing for the Lord's service. One cannot serve the Lord without being situated on the spiritual platform. Thus, if a so-called material thing is dovetailed in the service of the Lord, it is no longer to be considered material. Thus, the pure devotee, in his perfect vision, sees from all angles. Pare brahma nichatmanam param brahma tatatmani vikshamano vihayeksham asmad upararamaha. King Malayadraja could thus observe that the Supersoul was sitting by his side and that he as the individual soul was sitting by the side of the Supersoul. Since both were together, there was no need for separate interests. Thus he ceased from such activities. So this verse is describing oneness. And I would say that although we have a philosophy of achintya bheda, bheda, tattva, simultaneously absolute, inconceivable oneness and difference between the soul and the Lord, we generally emphasize the difference. And we do that for a very good reason, as we say, Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvisesha Sunyavadi Paskatya Desh Pacharane, that you have come to defeat impersonalism and voidism. So these impersonalistic and voidist concepts are very prominent in the world today. When people want to attain to some state of spirituality, when they want to be religious, there is a tendency at the present time, and for quite some time on the earth, for a person to take up a path of impersonalism or voidism. And this tendency has been there since the beginning of time, but it's particularly prominent right now. It's of interest, of course, that the demons that the Lord kills, often, not always, but often, they enter into some kind of merging. Either they merge into the Lord's effulgence, or they merge into the Lord's body. So that's quite common. And Srila Prabhupada and our acharyas talk about that, why should we aspire for a liberation that is attained by the Lord's enemies, that's attained by demons? It must not be very desirable. One of the most fascinating things that I found is in reading the books of my late godbrother, Sataputta Prabhu, who wrote on science, and he wrote his book, Alien Identities. In that book, he said that the evidence of non-human beings visiting this planet, non-human intelligent beings visiting this planet, was that they were preaching some sort of impersonalistic philosophy. So it's not just that the demons who are killed by the Lord generally have some sort of an impersonal type of liberation that they attain, whether the Lord's effulgence or the Lord's body, but also that demons have a religion. I mean, even simple indigenous cultures have some sort of a religion. All human beings have some sort of a religion. I mean, there's a book that I read many years ago, decades ago, called Confessions of a Medical Heretic. And in there, a medical doctor writes about how modern medicine has become a kind of religion, with the doctors as the high priests of that religion. It's fascinating. So everyone has a religion. Their religion might not include God. They might have a religion, some religion of science and technology. You know, that the absolute truth is a cold, impersonal universe, and that we're going to attain enlightenment and freedom, liberation by science and technology. But there's still something where human beings explain what is the meaning and purpose of life and how to attain it. So the demons, and we're talking about demons here, actually like beings in the universe who are demoniac. There's like demoniac races of beings in the universe. So they have a religion, and not only those demoniac beings, but demoniac beings on Earth, human beings who are demoniac, who are against God. They may have a voidistic religion, they may have a materialistic religion. Matter is God, matter is supreme. But if they're going to be spiritual, they usually have some impersonal or voidist type of religion. And some variety of impersonalism or Buddhism has become extremely popular in the modern world, and in all the countries, the West, the East, and places that you can't call West or East, like Russia or Peru, that is neither Western nor Eastern. So this impersonalism has become very popular. There are impersonalistic authors and teachers who are making millions of dollars by teaching an impersonal or voidist form of meditation, who are teaching some impersonal or voidist form of Gyan Yoga. So they're teaching Gyan Yoga and Dhyan Yoga. Sometimes they're teaching Karma Yoga. Sometimes they even teach kinds of Bhakti Yoga. So my late ex-brother-in-law, he used to say, I should call him my brother outlaw, he used to give Diksha in an impersonal line, some impersonal parampara, and he thought you could become one with Hanuman, so he would worship Hanuman. He had a deity of Hanuman, he had a deity of Krishna too. It has I call them supermarket altars. So he had lots of deities. Westerner, brought up in America, Caucasian. So he had a supermarket altar. And when he died, he was meditating on Hanuman, and not with the idea of entering into Ram's pastimes and serving Lord Ramachandra, but with the idea that he would become Hanuman, that he would merge into Hanuman. And he had thousands of followers, thousands. So this is even some form of, you could say, bhakti, looks like bhakti, but it's impersonal. And so because of all this impersonalism, therefore the emphasis that Srila Prabhupada gave everywhere was on personalism. He was constantly... constantly emphasizing personalism. And because of that, we are emphasizing constantly in our Hare Krishna movement the difference between ourselves and the Lord. And this is the, like, pounding, you know. And when Prabhupada talks about the oneness, he usually talks about the oneness in a way that's not inconceivable. He'll usually talk about the oneness in a that's not in a chinta way. You know, well, there's some oneness of quality. I like that. Actually, a chinta beta tattva means that there is absolute oneness and absolute difference, and that the fact that both of them coexist is a chincha. But again, Srila Prabhupada, due to time, place, and circumstances, he was very open about the fact that he was emphasizing the difference, and that when he spoke about oneness, he would speak about it in a very qualified way. However, we do have a philosophy of achincha beta beta tattva. We do have a philosophy that there is an inconceivable absolute oneness and absolute difference simultaneously. And this particular verse, as in a number of verses in the Bhagavatam especially, other shastras that we read as well, but of all the shastras we read, particularly the Bhagavatam, there's a number of verses that are pointing to this oneness. So here Srila Prabhupada is explaining this oneness in two ways in the verse and purport. I thought we would explore each of these and then look at in what ways in our sadhana we can hope to achieve this kind of oneness. And the oneness that the devotees seek is not a losing of one's identity. Of course, you can't really lose your identity, but it's not even a sense of losing your identity. I mean, when we're in deep sleep at night, we hardly know that we exist, but we do exist. We do exist. We do have our identity. We are a separate person. Just because we have a time of deep sleep doesn't obviate the fact that we exist as a separate person. So even if people merge into the Brahman or they merge into Krishna's body, they are eternally, Krishna tells Arjuna, they're always in the past, always in the present, always in the future. We're always separate, individual persons. All right, let's look at the ways of oneness, because a part of the bliss of service is that there is a oneness. Yeah? I mean, if we think about any relationship of love we have, love or affection, with any other living being, we will see there's some area of oneness. Just that we're both alive. You know, even if you're having a relationship of love with your lizard or something. I knew someone who had a pet spider. I don't relate. But, you know, you have a pet tarantula spider. I mean, I actually knew somebody with a pet tarantula spider. What's the oneness? The oneness is you're both alive. You can't really have a relationship with your car. You know, the only way you can have a relationship with your car is by pretending that your car is alive. I mean, I guess you can do that today because your car talks to you. You know, you can have these computer things in your car and your car has its built-in GPS and says, turn right. Would you like me to... You have an incoming call. Would you like me to answer the call? It sounds like you have a personal assistant in your car. But you can't really have a relationship with your car. Well, there's no point of commonality. And the more we have in common with someone, the more relationship we can have with them. This is why people try to marry somebody who's compatible. I mean, just everywhere. Whether you work out compatibility through a horoscope or through your parents looking at their family or through dating somebody for 10 years or however you try to figure out whether or not you're compatible, you try to figure out, do we have enough points in common that we are going to be able to establish a loving relationship? If the only thing I have in common with someone is that we're both living humans and we have no other points in common, if we diverge in our, you know, our living habits, our eating habits, our political views, our religious views, our views on relationships, you know, if all the points in which we're going to work together, we have divergent views, we're not going to be able to have a relationship. I remember years ago, some devotee asking me, we were running a school, and asking if we would hire a specific other devotee as a teacher in the school. So I didn't do it as like a formal interview, but I was casually speaking to this prospective teacher and just asking him, you know, just talking about education. And it became very clear to me within about a half an hour that our views on teaching and learning were highly divergent. And basically, I didn't see any way that those views could be accommodated in one school unless either I decided that I was going to agree with him or he decided he was going to agree with me. And being as he was my godbrother and he was also highly educated, I just didn't see it. I saw that, you know, he was a peer and neither would he subordinate himself to me nor would I subordinate myself to him. And so I went to the devotee who had asked if we could hire him and I said, you know, I'm sure he's a great teacher, but he's not going to agree to teach the way I want to teach, and I'm not going to agree to teach the way he wants to teach. We're just not compatible. So we're not, you know, we could have a friendly relationship, but we wouldn't be able to have a working relationship. It's just not function. So my point is there has to be some degree of oneness, and we look for relationships where there's a large degree of oneness. And this is true not only, you know, in our working partners, in our romantic partners. If people are like this with their children. You know, people are thrilled when their children look like them. It's just, they're absolutely thrilled. And they're thrilled if their children have similar personalities to them. I was really thinking about this yesterday. You know, oh, my son is a mini-me. You know, my daughter is a mini-me. And why do we feel like that? Why do we feel like I want my child to be similar to me? You know, I was like, isn't that kind of imposing something on your kids? But If there isn't commonality, it's hard to have a relationship. You know, when we're with somebody whose views and lifestyle is very divergent, then it's hard to even talk about anything. It's hard to do anything together. I mean, this happened when I took up Krishna consciousness. I was still in the university, I was still in college, and some of my friends stopped being friends with me. They said, "We don't have anything in common anymore. We have nothing to talk about. There's nothing we can do together. All the things we used to do together, you don't do anymore." So this oneness is also important. I mean, if we just think, yes, 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 we have a philosophy of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, but, you know, the oneness, that's the purview of the impersonalists, and we don't want to be impersonalists, so we're just going to focus on the difference. But both have to be there. So let's look at these two things. Prabhupada's talking about personal interest, and then he's talking about the nature of the Lord's energy. And again, we're going to look at each of these in turn, and then how we can practice these, because I'm assuming that everyone listening to this class is a sadhaka. Some of you may be in bhava or prema, but if we're going to assume that we're sadhakas, then we want to know how to practice these mentalities. Okay, first one is our personal interest. So this is right in the verse. There was no need for separate interests. They were the same. They were the same. There was no need for separate interest. This is when the Lord's interest and the Lord's happiness we experience as our interest and our happiness, and where the Lord experiences our interest and our happiness as his interest and his happiness. It's a two-way street. Materially speaking, we have these situations that are very exploitive, or like political dictators, where they tell you, you know, they tell their citizens that you just have to work for the good of the state, or you just have to work for the good of the dictator, and then you'll be taken care of. But the dictator never puts the happiness of the people in general as equal to his, generally it's him, equal to his own happiness. And after a while, the people start feeling, hey, wait a minute, I'm being exploited. I'm asked to have the wishes and the interests and the happiness of this dictator as if it were mine. And I become lost. I don't feel satisfied, I'm just lost. You know, and it happens in religious organizations. You know, it happens in cults, as we call them. Or, you know, where there's some leader, there's some priest or whatever, who convinces everyone in his group, again, it's usually a him, not always, usually. He convinces everyone in his group that everyone should give everything to him. So people are giving the group leader, you know, their $100,000 in savings, they're giving the group leader their car. There are sometimes when they give the group leader their wife. So there are some cults where, you know, the group leader has a sexual relation with all the women. So even, you know, your wife also has to have a relation with the group leader. So like that. You have to give me everything. And you can't have any separate interests other than mine. So these are very exploitative relationships in this world. The person is trying to use all the other people as extensions of themselves. They realize that they have a limited capacity to accomplish things, and so they use other people as extensions of their own senses. Yeah, so, I mean, in one sense, all human beings do this, to some extent. Like Prabhupada talked about extended sense gratification, where we work in a family unit, we work in a village, and the things that I cannot achieve on my own, I'm trying to achieve through other people that are favorable to me. But usually in those situations, we try to be reciprocal. So I try to meet your needs, and you're going to meet my needs. But I don't really have your interest at heart, and you don't really have my interest at heart in the same way we're talking about spiritually. So it's not like the dictator who just kind of wants to swallow you and use you and subsume you for his own purposes, and not really care about what you get out of it. It's not like that. It's more of a reciprocal thing. I take care of you, and you take care of me. But it's still not really a oneness of interest. It just, what we're talking about here with Krishna is quite different. And the reason is that Krishna is the, as Prabhupada says here, the way he translates it twice, is the super soul. So if we look at the verse, okay, we have this Brahmani Chatmanam, we have Atma, Param Brahma, Tat Atmani. So we have Brahman and we have self. So the super self, the self of the self. If we think about, materially speaking, the universe is the Lord's body, and the Lord as Garbhodakshay Vishnu and Shirodakshay Vishnu, well, Shirodakshay Vishnu particularly, is the soul of the body. So the universe is his body, and then he is the soul of that body. Like Kunti prayed to him, you are the form of the universe, you are the soul of the universe. And Prabhupada says, at least in one place, that we are like cells in the universal body. So if we think about our own material body, so my consciousness is spread throughout this body. If I pinch my finger, I can feel it. I pull my hair. My consciousness is spread throughout the body. And then there's also little cells. So there's little skin cells and muscle cells and heart cells and lung cells. And these cells each have their own little lives. They eat, sleep, mate, and defend. They are born. They grow, they reproduce, produce byproducts, they dwindle and die, and they have their own little desires. I mean, it's pretty primitive, one would assume, but they still have some desire. They have hunger, they need food, they need oxygen, they need to get rid of carbon dioxide, they need to breathe oxygen, and they have to hang around with their little buddies. I don't know how many desires they have. Beyond that, I don't know if they feel that they're doing anything purposeful or meaningful by being part of my lungs. But in any case, they have their own little desires, yes, and then I have my desires. So I am their super self. They are each a self, right? The little heart muscle cell, it's alive. It's a self. But I am the super self for them. I am the over self, yes? The self in the heart cell is not the self of my body. I am the self of my body. And like I'm willing my hand, I don't even really know how I do it. Of course, in one sense, I'm doing it with the help of the demigods. I'm moving my hand, willing my hand to move, and the cells in my bones and in my muscles and my nerves and my blood and my skin, they all have to work together, right? I'm moving my hand, that's stretching my skin in various ways. It's moving the muscles and the ligaments and the bones, and those little cells have to be obedient to me. You know, and if they're not, it's really a problem. You know, if your hand's shaking and you can't get it to do what you want it to do, it's a problem, right? Or if it's, you know, limp and like in a stroke and you can't get it, then it's a problem. Huh? So the little cells may still be living in the shaking hand or the limp hand, but they're not in the service of me. And then beyond me, there's a super self. So just like the little cells in my body are meant to serve me, so I, as a cell in the universal body, is meant to serve the soul of the universe, is meant to serve Krishna. And just like the cells in my skin, if they serve me, then they are also happy. They are also fulfilled. I desire their happiness, in fact. I mean, some people don't, I suppose, the way they eat, the way they live. They don't care about the happiness of the little cells in their body. But a reasonable person, I desire that my skin cells are happy. I desire that my heart muscle cells are happy. I want them to be happy. Back to Swarup Damodar Maharaj once asked Prabhupada, when we take prasadam, does it benefit the cells in our body? And in addition to our bodily cells, we have commensals. And if we're unlucky, we have parasites. So, or we have entities that are in a symbiotic relationship with us, but they're not part of the body. So all of us have bacteria in our small and large intestine. And without that bacteria, we're not healthy. But it's not part of our body per se. So I'm giving those bacteria a home in my intestines, and they're providing me with the proper environment to digest my food. The same is true in my mouth and so forth. you know, and then I have entities that don't do any good for me, that are, you know, like those little mites in our eyelashes and things like that. Anyway, so Bhakti Sarvadharma Maharaj asked Srila Prabhupada, do our cells benefit? And Prabhupada was talking more about the worms in our intestines than about the cells, but he laughed, and he said, yes, they are benefited. He said, so you are eating prasadam for others. So, you know, okay, this is my preaching program. I'm going to eat prasadam and benefit all the little cells in my body. But anyway, the point is that there's a oneness. There's a oneness. There's a oneness of interest. The health, my interest is to have healthy cells in my body, and the healthy cells in my body have an interest that I am healthy overall. Right? Each little heart muscle cell has an interest that my body is in good holistic health, and I, the big soul in the body, figuratively speaking, I have an interest that each of my little heart muscle cells is in good working order. So having a separate interest is destructive. Right? We were saying some people don't really care about the various cells in their body. Right? People who drink a lot of alcohol, they don't care what that's doing to their liver, how that's stressing their liver, how it's harming their liver. Right? Or people who eat too much and become obese, they don't care how doing that is stressing the various organs of their body. Oh, there's a lot of people that do self-destructive things. Right? It's fascinating, you know, some people who are vehemently against modern pharmaceuticals, and they'll go eat a hamburger at McDonald's. You know, I don't want to put any toxins in my body, and then they're eating, you know, horrible things. You know, drinking Coca-Cola, they're eating McDonald's hamburgers, or they're smoking, or they're drinking. So those people don't have a sense of a shared interest. Such people don't consider that the interests of the cells of my body is also my interest. And sometimes you have the bodily cells also don't act in harmony. Some bodily cells may say, you know, well, I have my own interest. I'm not here to serve the body, I'm here to serve myself. And then that's what we call cancer, when the cells develop their own interest. So here Malaya Dwaj could actually experience, it wasn't theoretical, it wasn't a philosophical idea, he's actually experiencing. Like if you could imagine, you know, some little cell in your heart kind of wakes up and goes, oh, I'm in a body that's bigger than myself. I'm not just hanging out with my heart cell buddies. You know, we're a heart, and there's lungs, and there's a liver, and there's an esophagus, and there's a, you know, to actually realize that. So if the soul realizes, oh, there's a God, there's a soul of the universe, and I am a part of that God, why should I do anything separately? I will be happy if we are working together. I'll be happy. And again, it's not an exploitive relationship. It's not a dictatorship, because Krishna is just as interested in making the cells happy, the jivas happy, like I'm as interested in making my bodily cells happy as they should be in making me happy. So then also we have an interesting oneness that Prabhupada talks about in this purport, one of these fascinating purports. And fascinating because there's also a lot of statements like Dukalayama Shastratam, Asukama Nityam, that this material world is both temporary and miserable. There's a lot of statements like that in the Shastra. We have the whole description of the forest of material enjoyment in the fifth canto by Jed Bharata Maharashtrahugana, where, you know, all the nature of the misery of this world, you know, there's the mountain with thorns, and there's the beehive, and there's the wasps, and there's the lion, and they all represent different sufferings here. And one of our main preaching to people is there is matter and there's spirit, and the material world is miserable and the spiritual world is happy. You know, this is kind of the cornerstone of our basic, hello, welcome to the Hare Krishna temple, preaching, your body is material and you are spiritual, the world is material and there's a spiritual world, matter is miserable, spirit is happy. But here Srila Prabhupada is giving another perspective, that there is no matter. Matter is a state of consciousness. Matter is a state of consciousness. Material means a state of forgetfulness, as Krishna defines it, seeing something valuable without relationship to him. That's what materialism means. So when I actually see that the universe is the body of the Lord, and I see that the Lord is the soul of the universe, then I see that everything is spiritual. Sarva Kalamidam Brahma, as Prabhupada says here. Everything is spiritual. There's one lecture where Srila Prabhupada says, there is no material world, there is no material world, there is no material world. So yes, the material world is miserable. As soon as we have a materialistic consciousness, we are miserable. And as soon as we don't have a materialistic consciousness, we are happy. The external circumstances are not relevant. If you're in materialistic consciousness, external circumstances are very important. But if you're in spiritual consciousness, frankly, they're not. If you're in spiritual consciousness, as Lord Shiva told Parvati at the cursing of Chitraketu, the devotee can be happy in heaven or in hell. The devotee doesn't... Maybe there's not so much noise anymore. No. To the devotee, there is no such thing as heaven or hell. Heaven is it's a phantasmagoria. It doesn't mean anything. Enjoyment is Krishna, and seeing everything in relationship with Krishna, and suffering is seeing things as separate from Krishna. And that's all. You know, we can have some idea of this, again, in our mundane relationships. So you see, you know, a married couple, and when they're having some misunderstanding, when they're having an argument, disagreement, and you're around them, it's very uncomfortable. They feel uncomfortable. Everyone who's around them feels very uncomfortable. That they've temporarily, hopefully temporarily, they've lost that oneness of interest. And when they've lost that, and there's discord between them, it's miserable. And when they have a feeling of harmony between them, it's wonderful. And you know, we see this in any of our human relationships. So this is true about with the world also. When I perceive the world as, oh, it's Krishna. It's Krishna's body. It's Krishna's energy. Everything. And then everything becomes beautiful and everything is perfect. That doesn't mean that... you don't work for righting of wrongs. The Bhagavatam is full of stories of great saintly kings, Rajarshi, who would work to right wrongs in the world while having this vision of Sarva Kalamidam Brahma. Everything is perfect, everything is Krishna, everything is spiritual, and this is my service. My service is to help others to see that, and that may sometimes be done through police work, through war, as in the Battle of Kurukshetra. So how can we develop these two things? How can we go from seeing the material world as the material world and seeing my own interests as separate to this oneness in our sadhana? So one thing is that we can practice having the same interest as the Lord. And one of the easiest ways of doing this is to be enthused by the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The preaching mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I've just found it's extremely easy. I mean, Krishna Das Kaviraj says anyone who remembers Lord Chaitanya, they'll find difficult things to be easy. And if you forget Lord Chaitanya, you'll find easy things to be difficult. But especially this incarnation of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his mood is to bring this awareness of spirituality to the world. And the more we bring it to the world, the more we get it ourselves. Why? Because in the process of bringing it to the world, I am acting as if I already have it. The Lord's interest is to bring everyone to Krishna consciousness. Therefore, when I act to bring others to Krishna consciousness, I am acting in harmony with the Lord's interest, and therefore I am more likely to see my interest in the Lord's interest as being one. I start getting my happiness from being involved in Mahaprabhu's mission. And, of course, Srila Prabhupada's genius is finding ways for people to be involved in Mahaprabhu's mission, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whether you're old, whether you're young, whether you're black, whether you're white, whether you're green, whether you're purple, whether you're, you know, from this culture or that culture. Whether you're married, whether you're five times divorced, whatever you are, how to engage in Lord Chaitanya's mission. Stanisthita, whatever you are, status, whatever. But become a guru and teach others in some way. Distributing prasadam, distributing the holy name. Just being an exemplar of being conscious of Krishna. And in this way, we sync our interests with the interest of the Lord. And another way, of course, is deity worship, where you have the Lord in your home as the center of your home. You have some nice altar, even if it's just a shelf or something. You make something nice. You get fresh flowers and aromatic incense and nice food stuff. And so you start to feel, my home belongs to God. As Bhaktivinoda writes in his songs, you know, this is the Lord's home, and my family members are his servants. And whatever money I collect is to take care of the Lord's servants. Something like, you know, we have a temple, and in a temple, the deities own the temple. They own the buildings, they own the properties. And the people who live at the temple are the servants of the deities. And so if I'm going out to make money for the temple, I'm maintaining the Lord and his servants. Yeah? So it's like that. My home becomes a temple. So in that way also, although preaching is, being involved in Mahaprabhu's mission is more powerful. And Krishna says that one who explains this secret is the most dear to me. So that's more powerful. Although we have, like Prabhupada would say, Bhagavat Marg and Pancho Trikhi Marg going on parallel tracks. But definitely preaching is more powerful. But deity worship is also very powerful. And that way we start to feel enlivened by putting the Lord first. And we start to directly experience Pratyaksha Avagamam Dharmam, that when we put the Lord first and we make the Lord's interest first, that our interests, our desires become satisfied. You practically experience that. And then the other way is to see the Lord, to see the world as spiritual. This instruction is given in the Bhagavad Gita in the 7th, 9th, 10th, and 15th chapter, and it's given in the Bhagavatam, especially in the 2nd and the 8th cantos, and to some extent the 12th canto, where we see the world, we see Krishna in the world. Of, you know, luminaries in the sky at night, I am the moon of lights, I am the radiant sun, I am the ability in man, I am the taste in water, I am the fragrance of the earth. The clouds are like the hairs on my head, I am the sound in ether. So we actually, as sadhakas, we should be meditating on these. Now, it's not just some list we go through in our, you know, in our reading and we forget about it, but we actually should meditate throughout our day on how what we're interacting with in the world is Krishna. And then, of course, Srila Prabhupada's making the point in the purport he makes all the time that we should be using things in Krishna's service. Now, using things in Krishna's service goes with both things. Using things in Krishna's service goes with that I don't have a separate interest from that of the Lord, and that I see that the whole world is the Lord. It's not just the Lord's property, but actually is the Lord. So when I see that the world is the body of the Lord, and when I have no separate interest, then naturally I'm going to use everything to serve Him in a very practical way. And so this is something that even beginners can learn. You know, we should use everything in Krishna's service. And then we can experience this oneness, which is the basis for having the Lord as an individual and me as an individual having a loving relationship. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, corrections?
Oh, boy, something. This is so. Okay, I think I figured it out. Okay, there you go.
Pergola duty.
Yes.
We dug there. Is your brother-in-law famous?
Oh, he was famous in his own circle.
Was he a follower of Baba Ram Dass?
I am not sure. Yeah, I know he was involved with the Golden Temple in South India.
Not the Golden Temple, the Sikh Golden Temple.
No, he wasn't a Sikh.
I really, really, really liked this class. I got a lot out of it.
Oh, thank you. By the way, my late ex-brother-in-law met Srila Prabhupada in 26 Second Avenue a few times.
Wow.
And, well, he and my sister, they were married at the time, they lived just like around the corner on the Lower East Side. And he also went to our Krishna Balaram Temple in Vrindavan. He visited me two or three times at various temples, took a lot of prasadam, and he was very favorable to, you know, it was one of those yatamatatapats, so he was very favorable to Krishna consciousness and really supported me in my own spiritual journey. His initiated name was Ramana Das. He was also a musician, an incredible musician, actually. He had a perfect pitch, and he had, what do they say, they call somebody who can remember anything and just play by remembering it. What do you call that?
Right.
You know, he could hear something and then just sit down at the piano and play it perfectly. But he had thousands and thousands of followers. I know he would go to Burning Man regularly. And what they did was, they did a little funeral for him, but more than that, like in the 2 weeks before he died, they were doing celebrations of life kind of thing. In lieu of, you know, they wanted to do that when he was alive rather than put all the emphasis on a funeral. And many, many, many thousands of people came to see him or write him and things like that. So he was very well known within his own circle. And there's many people like that. I mean, there's many people teaching some kind of impersonal something.
Yeah, I went to Taos, and it was Baba Ram Dass's group, and because a friend of mine was really into Hanuman, they had a flying Hanuman deity, beautiful deity, and we went there for Hanuman Jayanti. But on the bulletin board, they only had two dates that they observed out of the year. One was Hanuman Jayanti, and the other one was Shivaratri. So they were worshipping Hanuman as an aspect of Shiva.
Mm. That's quite common, actually.
But that's what reminded me when you said he meditated on Hanuman at the end. Yeah. The group is very much into the Hanuman Chalisa.
Yeah, they were singing, when he died, they were singing the Hanuman Chalisa. My late ex-brother-in-law, yeah, they were singing that.
I really like your analogy of the human body. It sounded like you're describing us as mini-gods.
We are. We are. We are mini-gods. That's exactly what we are. We are a mini-god in the universe of our own little body. Yes, we are. And to some extent in our environment, you know, I'm a little mini god of my room or my home or my car. And some people are, you know, bigger mini gods, and some people are smaller mini gods. Just like in the universe, the demigods, some of them are, you know, some have more power than others. But yeah, we are. That's what we came to this world to be. We came to this world to be God. So, okay, you're God of a house. You're God of a family. You're God of a body. At least you're the God of the body. And all these little cells are your obedient servants, hopefully. They're not always so obedient.
Back in, I think, 1974, Frida Ananda Maharaj was visiting us in Miami, and Dhamma Hanfrapu asked him, he said, are we like the demigod of the body? Frida Ananda said, he said, we're the fool of the body.
but we are the demigod of the body. We really are. I mean, this body is a whole, it's a whole complex universe. And yes, we are the demigod of the body, definitely.
Yeah, Madan's point was good. Yeah, are we the demigod? I mean, just, he added such humor to it, but it's true too. We're so foolish, the fool of the body. Because we have such a valuable, it was such a valuable, suitable ship to take us back to Godhead. And if we're not taking advantage of it, then we're the greatest fool.
Right.
I had a question. I kind of lost the thread a little, where it talked in the verse about the king could thus observe the super soul was sitting by his side. What was the could thus? So that usually means something happened before, and now he could observe it. So do you understand what that is?
He's engaged. He's engaged in jnana. He's engaged in bhakti. He's a devotee. His children are the processes of bhakti. But he's engaged in bhakti primarily through meditation. The primary anga of bhakti he's engaging in is meditation, and it might even be called jnana nidra bhakti. And so in his state of meditation in the forest, he's gaining realization of the soul and the super soul.
So something like, for one who has conquered the mind, the super soul's already reached.
Yes, but his process for conquering the mind is mostly sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita stuff.
Okay.
But it's still in bhakti. I mean, he's worshipping the Lord. He's not meditating to realize Brahman or to realize Paramatma. He's meditating for Bhagavan realization.
And the unification process was devotion,
yes,
to overcome the selfishness of the separated mentality.
Correct. Absolutely.
Thank
correct,
you.
Yes. And we find, you know, his, like I say, his children, this is a metaphor, this story. We're still in a metaphor. We're still in an analogy. He's not a real person.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have things in the scripture that are both real people and metaphorical. This is only metaphorical. So he's a king who marries Paranjana, who's now become a woman, and his children are all, he's a great devotee. His children are all the personification of the limbs of bhakti. And after turning over the world to those who practice bhakti, he goes into a meditative trance, where he fully realizes the position of the Lord and his oneness with the Lord in bhakti. And then we're going to see, as we go on here, after he passes, his wife, who was Paranjana in her previous life, she's lamenting, and then the Lord himself comes in the form of a brahmana to console her. And says, you know, I'm your old friend.
Because he was caught on the karmakanda section with doing a lot of sacrifices.
That was Paranjana in his previous life.
Okay. So now he's cleared away in that misconception of...
Yes, that's the wife of this king. No, that's the wife of this king. So who we're reading about today is Malayadwaj. Malayadwaj has a wife, Vidarbhi. Vidarbhi, in her last life, was Paranjana, who was this ritualistic person. And Paranjana dies thinking of his wife. Becomes a woman, but as a woman, she marries Malayadwaj, who's a great devotee. So, I mean, as one of my friends likes to point out, although Prabhupada makes comments about how it's unfortunate for a man to take birth as a woman, in this particular instance, that was the great fortune of this jiva. That this jiva as a man was just trying to be the enjoyer of the world in a karmakanda way, and as a woman, marries this great devotee, has children who are the personification of the devotional angas, goes with her husband into the forest as a vanaprastha, and after the death of her husband, meets the Supreme Lord face to face, and herself becomes a pure devotee and goes back to Godhead. So Narada Muni, in telling this story to King Krishnabharisha, who's entangled in materialistic activities, is giving him not only the faults of his current life through the life of Paranjana, but also the solution to the faults in this life of Vidarbhi and Malayadwaj.
If you read the
previous verses, Madan, if you read the previous
yes,
verses 40 and 41, you'll understand that the king realized the super soul as separate from the soul and the body. And then he was getting direct instructions from the super soul, 10:10, which Prabhupada quotes in the purport of the previous verse. And so he's in a direct dialogue with the super soul. The super soul.
Yeah, I missed a week.
Yeah. Well, this is also, it's a complex story because it's Narada talking to Prishnabharisha, telling this allegorical story of Paranjana, who then becomes Vidarbhi. So it's a little difficult because it's so many layers here. Yeah. Yeah. All right, well, thank you very, very much. Anybody else before we end?
Okay, thank you, Mataji.
Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Arigato.